Wow.
What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Chapter 40 of The Phantom Ship by Frederick Marriott. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 40. Although tomorrow was to end all Amin's hopes and fears, all her short happiness, her suspense and misery, yet Amin slept until her last slumber in this world was disturbed by the unlocking and unbarring of the doors of her cell and the appearance of the head jailer with a light. Amin started up. She had been dreaming of her husband, of happiness. She awoke to the sad reality. There stood the jailer with a dress in his hand, which he desired she would put on. He lighted a lamp for her and left her alone. The dress was of black serge with white stripes. Amin put on the dress and threw herself down on the bed, trying, if possible, to recall the dream from which she had been awakened, but in vain. 2 hours passed away, and the jailer again entered and summoned her to follow him. Perhaps one of the most appalling customs of the Inquisition is that after accusation, whether the accused parties confess their guilt or not, they return to their dungeons without the least idea of what may have been their sentence, and when summoned on the morning of the execution, they are equally kept in ignorance. The prisoners were all summoned by the jailers from the various dungeons, and led into a large hall, where they found their fellow sufferers collected. In this spacious, dimly lighted hall were to be seen about 200 men, standing up, as if for support, against the walls, all dressed in the same black and white serge. So motionless, so terrified were they, that if it had not been for the rolling of their eyes, as they watched the jailers who passed and repassed, you might have imagined them to be petrified. It was the agony of suspense, worse than the agony of death. After a time, a wax candle about 5 feet long was put into the hands of each prisoner, and then some were ordered to put on over their dress the sanbenitos, others the samarias. Those who received these dresses with flames painted on them gave themselves up for lost, and it was dreadful to perceive the anguish of each individual as the dresses were one by one brought forward, and with the heavy drops of perspiration on his brows, he watched with terror lest one should be presented to him. All was doubt, fear, and horror. But the prisoners in this hall were not those who were to suffer death. Those who wore the sanbenitos had to walk in the procession and receive but slight punishment. Those who wore the samarias had been condemned but had been saved from the consuming fire by an acknowledgment of their offence. The flames painted on their dresses were reversed and signified that they were not to suffer. But this the unfortunate wretches did not know, and the horrors of a cruel death stared them in the face. Another hall, similar to the one in which the men had been collected, was occupied by female culprits. The same ceremonies were observed. The same doubt, fear, and agony were depicted upon every countenance. But there was a third chamber, smaller than the other two, and this chamber was reserved for those who had been sentenced and who were to suffer at the stake. It was into this chamber that Amin was led, and there she found 7 other prisoners, dressed in the same manner as herself. 2 only were Europeans, the other 5 were negro slaves. Each of these had their confessor with them, and were earnestly listening to his exhortation. A monk approached Amin, but she waved him away with her hand. He looked at her, spat on the floor, and cursed her. The head jailer now made his appearance with the dresses for those who were in this chamber. These were Samarias, only different from the others, inasmuch as the flames were painted on them upwards instead of down. These dresses were of grey stuff, and loose, like a wagoner's frock. At the lower part of them, both before and behind, was painted the likeness of the wearer, that is, the face only, resting upon a burning faggot, and surrounded with flames and demons. Under the portrait was written the crime for which the party suffered. Sugarloaf caps with flames painted on them were also brought and put on their heads, and the long wax candles were placed into their hands. Amin and the others condemned, being arrayed in these dresses, remained in the chambers for some hours before it was time for the procession to commence, for they had been all summoned up by the jailers at about 2 o'clock in the morning. The sun rose brilliantly, much to the joy of the members of the Holy Office, who would not have had the day obscured on which they were to vindicate the honour of the Church, and prove how well they acted up to the mild doctrines of the Saviour, those of charity, goodwill, forbearing one another, forgiving one another. God of heaven! And not only did those of the Holy Inquisition rejoice, but thousands and thousands more, who had flocked from all parts to witness the dreadful ceremony and to hold a jubilee. Many, indeed, actuated by fanaticism, superstition, but more attended from thoughtlessness and the love of pageantry. The streets and squares through which the procession was to pass were filled at an early hour. Silks, tapestries, and cloth of gold and silver were hung over the balconies and out of the windows in honour of the procession. Every balcony and window was thronged with ladies and cavaliers in their gayest attire, all waiting anxiously to see the wretches paraded before they suffered. But the world is fond of excitement, and where is anything so exciting as to a superstitious people as an auto da fe? As the sun rose, the heavy bell of the cathedral tolled, and all the prisoners were led down to the grand hall that the order of the procession might be arranged. At the large entrance door, on a raised throne, sat the grand inquisitor, encircled by many of the most considerable nobility and gentry of Goa. By the grand inquisitor stood his secretary, and as the prisoners walked past the throne and their names were mentioned, the secretary, after each, called out the names of one of those gentlemen, who immediately stepped forward and took his station by the prisoner. These people are termed the godfathers. Their duty is to accompany and be answerable for the prisoner, who is under their charge until the ceremony is over. It is reckoned a high honour conferred on those whom the Grand Inquisitor appoints to this office. At last the procession commenced. First was raised on high the standard of the Dominican Order of Monks, for the Dominican Order were the founders of the Inquisition, and claimed this privilege by prescriptive right. After the banner, the monks themselves followed in two lines. And what was the motto of their banner? Justitia et misericordia. Then followed the culprits, to the number of 300, each with his godfather by his side, and his large wax candle lighted in his hand. Those whose offences have been most venal walk first. All are bareheaded and barefooted. After this portion, who wore only the dress of black and white serge, came those who carried the sabenitos, then those who wore the samarias with the flames reversed. Here there was a separation in the procession, caused by a large cross with the carved image of our Saviour nailed to it, the face of the image carried forward. This was intended to signify that those in advance of the crucifix, and upon whom the Saviour looked down, were not to suffer, and that those who were behind, and upon whom his back was turned, were cast away, to perish for ever in this world, and the next. Behind the crucifix followed the 7 condemned, and, as the greatest criminal, Amin walked the last. But the procession did not close here. Behind Amin were five effigies raised high on poles, clothed in the same dresses painted with flames and demons. Behind each effigy was borne a coffin, containing a skeleton. The effigies were of those who had died in their dungeon, or expired under the torture, and who had been tried and condemned after their death, and sentenced to be burnt. These skeletons had been dug up, and were to suffer the same sentence as, had they still been living beings, they would have undergone. The effigies were to be tied to the stakes, and the bones were to be consumed. Then followed the members of the Inquisition, the familiars, monks, priests, and hundreds of penitents, in black dresses which concealed their faces, all with the lighted tapers in their hands. It was 2 hours before the procession, which had paraded through almost every important street in Goa, arrived at the cathedral, in which the further ceremonies were to be gone through. The barefooted culprits could now scarcely walk, the small sharp flints having so wounded their feet that their tracks up the steps of the cathedral were marked with blood. The grand altar of the cathedral was hung with black cloth and lighted up with thousands of tapers. On one side of it was a throne for the Grand Inquisitor, on the other a raised platform for the Viceroy of Goa and his suite. The centre aisle had benches for the prisoners and their godfathers, the other portions of the procession falling off to the right and left to the side aisles and mixing for the time with the spectators. As the prisoners entered the cathedral, they were led into their seats, those least guilty sitting nearest to the altar, and those who were condemned to suffer at the stake being placed the farthest from it. The bleeding Amin tottered to her seat and longed for the hour which was to sever her from a Christian world. She thought not of herself, nor of what she was to suffer. She thought but of Philip, of his being safe from these merciless creatures, of the happiness of dying first and of meeting him again in bliss. Worn with long confinement, with suspense and anxiety, fatigued and suffering from her painful walk and the exposure to the burning sun, after so many months' incarceration in a dungeon, she no longer shone radiant with beauty. But still there was something even more touching in her careworn yet still perfect features. The object of universal gaze, she had walked with her eyes cast down and nearly closed. But occasionally, when she did look up, the fire that flashed from them spoke the proud soul within, and many feared and wondered, while more pitied that one so young and still so lovely should be doomed to such an awful fate. Amin had not taken her seat in the cathedral more than a few seconds, when, overpowered by her feelings and by fatigue, she fell back in a swoon. Did no one step forward to assist her, to raise her up, and offer her restoratives? No, not one. Hundreds would have done so, but they dared not. She was an outcast, excommunicated, abandoned, and lost. And should anyone, moved by compassion for a suffering fellow creature, have ventured to raise her up, he would have been looked upon with suspicion, and most probably have been arraigned, and have had to settle the affair of conscience with the Holy Inquisition. After a short time, two of the officers of the Inquisition went to Amin and raised her again in her seat, and she recovered sufficiently to enable her to retain her posture. A sermon was then preached by a Dominican monk, in which he portrayed the tender mercies, the paternal love, of the Holy Office. He compared the Inquisition to the Ark of Noah, out of which all the animals walked after the deluge, but with this difference, highly in favour of the Holy Office, that the animals went forth from the ark no better than they went in, whereas those who had gone into the Inquisition, with all the cruelty of disposition, and with the hearts of wolves, came out as mild and patient as lambs. The public accuser then mounted the pulpit, and read from it all the crimes of those who had been condemned, and the punishments which they were to undergo. Each prisoner, as the sentence was read, was brought forward to the pulpit by the officers, to hear their sentence, standing up, with their wax candles lighted in their hands. As soon as the sentences of all those whose lives had been spared were read, the Grand Inquisitor put on his priestly robes and, followed by several others, took off from them the ban of excommunication, which they were supposed to have fallen under, by throwing holy water on them with a small broom. As soon as this portion of the ceremony was over, those who were condemned to suffer, and the effigies of those who had escaped by death, were brought up one by one, and their sentences read. The winding up of the condemnation of all was in the same words, that the Holy Inquisition found it impossible, on account of the hardness of their hearts and the magnitude of their crimes, to pardon them. With great concern, it handed them over to secular justice to undergo the penalty of the laws, exhorting the authorities at the same time to show clemency and mercy towards the unhappy wretches, and if they must suffer death, that at all events it might be without the spilling of blood. What mockery was this apparent intercession, not to shed blood, when to comply with their request they substituted the torment and the agony of the stake. Amin was the last who was led forward to the pulpit, which was fixed against one of the massive columns of the centre aisle, close to the throne, occupied by the Grand Inquisitor.
"You, Amin van der Decken!" cried the public accuser.
At this moment an unusual bustle was heard in the crowd under the pulpit. There was struggling and expostulation, and the officers raised their wands for silence and decorum, but it continued.
"You, Amin van der Decken, being accused!"
Another violent struggle, and from the crowd darted a young man who rushed to where Amin was standing and caught her in his arms.
"Philip! Philip!"
screamed Amin, falling on his bosom. As he caught her, the cap of flames fell off her head and rolled along the marble pavement.
"My Amin, my wife, my adored one, is it thus we meet? My lord, she is innocent. Stand off, men," continued he to the officers of the Inquisition,
who would have torn them asunder.
"Stand off, or your lives shall answer for it."
This threat to the officers, and the defiance of all rules, were not to be borne. The whole cathedral was in a state of commotion, and the solemnity of the ceremony was about to be compromised. The viceroy and his followers had risen from their chairs to observe what was passing, and the crowd was pressing on, when the Grand Inquisitor gave his directions, and other officers hastened to the assistance of the two who had led Amin forward, and proceeded to disengage her from Philip's arms. The struggle was severe. Philip appeared to be endued with the strength of 20 men, and it was some minutes before they could succeed in separating him, and when they had done so, his struggles were dreadful. Amin, also, held by 2 of the familiars, shrieked as she attempted once more, but in vain, to rush into her husband's arms. At last, by a tremendous effort, Philip released himself, but as soon as he was released, he sank down helpless on the pavement. The exertion had caused the bursting of a blood vessel, and he lay without motion.
Oh God, they have killed him! Monsters, murderers, let me embrace him but once more!"
cried Amin frantically. The priest now stepped forward. It was Father Matthias, with sorrow in his countenance. He desired some of the bystanders to carry out Philip van der Decken, and Philip, in a state of insensibility, was borne away from the sight of Amin, the blood streaming from his mouth. Amin's sentence was read. She heard it not. Her brain was bewildered. She was led back to her seat, and then it was that all her courage, all her constancy and fortitude gave way, and during the remainder of the ceremony she filled the cathedral with her wild hysterical sobbing, all entreaties or threats being wholly lost upon her. All was now over, except the last and most tragical scene of the drama. The culprits who had been spared were led back to the Inquisition by their godfathers, and those who had been sentenced were taken down to the banks of the river to suffer. It was on a large open space on the left of the custom house that this ceremony was to be gone through. As in the cathedral, raised thrones were prepared for the Grand Inquisitor and the Viceroy, who, in state, headed the procession, followed by an immense concourse of people. 13 stakes had been set up, 8 for the living, 5 for the dead. The executioners were sitting on or standing by the piles of wood and faggots waiting for their victims. Amin could not walk. She was at first supported by the familiars, and then carried by them to the stake which had been assigned for her. When they put her on her feet opposite to it, her courage appeared to revive. She walked boldly up, folded her arms, and leant against it. The executioners now commenced their office. The chains were passed round Amin's body, the wood and faggots piled around her. The same preparations had been made with all the other culprits, and the confessors stood by the side of each victim. Amin waved her hand indignantly to those who approached her, when Father Matthias, almost breathless, made his appearance from the crowd through which he had forced his way.
Amin Vanderdecken, unhappy woman, had you been counselled by me, this would not have been. Now it is too late, but not too late to save your soul. Away then with this obstinacy, this hardness of heart. Call upon the blessed Saviour, that he may receive your spirit. Call upon his wounds for mercy. It is the 11th hour, but not too late. Amin, continued the old man with tears, I implore you, I conjure you, at least may this load of trouble be taken from my heart.
Unhappy woman, you say, replied she, say rather, unhappy priest, for Amin's sufferings will soon be over, while you must still endure the torments of the damned. Unhappy was the day when my husband rescued you from death. Still more unhappy the compassion which prompted him to offer you an asylum and a refuge. Unhappy the knowledge of you from the first day to the last. I leave you to your conscience, if conscience you retain, nor would I change this cruel death for the pangs which you in your future life will suffer. Leave me. I die in the faith of my forefathers, and scorn a creed that warrants such a scene as this.
Amin Vanderdecken, cried the priest on his knees,
clasping his hands in agony.
Leave me, father.
There is but a minute left, for the love of God.
I tell you then, leave me. That minute is my own.
Father Matthias turned away in despair, and the tears coursed down the old man's cheeks. As Amin said, his misery was extreme. The head executioner now inquired of the confessors whether the culprits died in the true faith. If answered in the affirmative, a rope was passed round their necks and twisted to the stake, so that they were strangled before the fire was kindled. All the other culprits had died in this manner, and the head executioner inquired of Father Matthias whether Amin had a claim to so much mercy. The old priest answered not, but shook his head. The executioner turned away. After a moment's pause, Father Matthias followed him and seized him by the arm, saying in a faltering voice,
Let her not suffer long.
The Grand Inquisitor gave the signal, and the fires were all lighted at the same moment. In compliance with the request of the priest, the executioner had thrown a quantity of wet straw upon Amin's pile, which threw up a dense smoke before it burnt into flames.
Mother, mother, I come to thee,
were the last words heard from Amin's lips. The flames soon raged furiously, ascending high above the top of the stake to which she had been chained. Gradually they sunk down, and only when the burning embers covered the ground, a few fragments of bones hanging on the chain were all that remained of the once peerless and high-minded Amin. The end of chapter 40. Recording by Andy Sames. Chapter 41 of The Phantom Ship by Frederick Marriott. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 41. Years have passed away since we related Amin's sufferings and cruel death, and now once more we bring Philip Vanderdecken on the scene. And during this time, where has he been? A lunatic, at one time frantic, chained, coerced with blows, at others, mild and peaceable. Reason occasionally appeared to burst out again, as the sun on a cloudy day,
and then it was again obscured. For many years there was one who watched him carefully, and lived in hope to witness his return to a sane mind. He watched in sorrow and remorse. He died without his desires being gratified. This was Father Matthias. The cottage at Terneuse had long fallen into ruin. For many years it waited the return of its owners, and at last the heirs at law claimed and recovered the substance of Philip van der Decken. Even the fate of Amin had passed from the recollection of most people, although her portrait, over burning coals, with her crime announced beneath it, still hangs, as is the custom in the Church of the Inquisition, attracting, from its expressive beauty, the attention of the most careless passers-by. But many, many years have rolled away. Philip's hair is white, his once powerful frame is broken down, and he appears much older than he really is. He is now sane, but his vigour is gone. Weary of life, all he wishes for is to execute his mission, and then to welcome death. The relic has never been taken from him. He has been discharged from the lunatic asylum, and has been provided with the means of returning to his country. Alas, he has now no country, no home, nothing in the world to induce him to remain in it. All he asks is to do his duty and to die. The ship was ready to sail for Europe, and Philip van der Decken went on board, hardly caring whither he went. To return to Terneuse was not his object. He could not bear the idea of revisiting the scene of so much happiness and so much misery. Amin's form was engraven on his heart, and he looked forward with impatience to the time when he should be summoned to join her in the land of spirits. He had awakened, as from a dream, after so many years of aberration of intellect. He was no longer the sincere Catholic that he had been, for he never thought of religion, without his Amin's cruel fate being brought to his recollection. Still, he clung on to the relic. He believed in that, and that only. It was his God, his creed, his everything, the passport for himself and for his father into the next world, the means whereby he should join his Amin, and for hours he would remain holding in his hand that object so valued, gazing upon it, recalling every important event in his life, from the death of his poor mother and his first sight of Amin, to the last dreadful scene. It was to him a journal of his existence, and on it were fixed all his hopes for the future. When, oh, when is it to be accomplished? Was the constant subject of his reveries. Blessed, indeed, will be the day when I leave this world of hate, and seek that other in which the weary are at rest. The vessel, on board of which Philip was embarked as a passenger, was the Nostra Senora da Monte, a brig of 300 tons bound for Lisbon. The captain was an old Portuguese, full of superstition and fond of arrack, a fondness rather unusual with the people of his nation. They sailed from Goa, and Philip was standing abaft, and sadly contemplating the spire of the cathedral in which he had last parted with his wife, when his elbow was touched, and he turned round.
"Fellow passenger again,"
said a well-known voice. It was that of the pilot, Shrifton. There was no alteration in the man's appearance. He showed no marks of declining years. His one eye glared as keenly as ever. Philip started, not only at the sight of the man, but at the reminiscences which his unexpected appearance brought to his mind. It was but for a second, and he was again calm and pensive. "You here again, Shrifton," observed Philip. "I trust your appearance forebodes the accomplishment of my task."
"Perhaps it does," replied the pilot. "We both are weary."
Philip made no reply. He did not even ask Shrifton in what manner he had escaped from the fort. He was indifferent about it, for he felt that the man had a charmed life.
"Many are the vessels that have been wrecked, Philip van der Decken, and many the souls summoned to their account by meeting with your father's ship, while you have been so long shut up,"
observed the pilot. "May our next meeting with him be more fortunate, may it be the last," replied Philip.
No, no. Rather may he fulfil his doom and sail till the day of judgment, replied the pilot with emphasis.
Vile Katif, I have a foreboding that you will not have your detestable wish. Away, leave me, or you shall find that although this head is blanched by misery, this arm still has some power.
Shrifton scowled as he walked away. He appeared to have some fear of Philip, although it was not equal to his hate. He now resumed his former attempts of stirring up the ship's company against Philip, declaring that he was a Jonas who would occasion the loss of the ship, and that he was connected with the Flying Dutchman. Philip very soon observed that he was avoided, and he resorted to counter-statements, equally injurious to Shrifton, whom he declared to be a demon. The appearance of Shrifton was so much against him, while that of Philip, on the contrary, was so prepossessing, that the people on board hardly knew what to think. They were divided. Some were on the side of Philip, some on that of Shrifton, the captain and many others looking with equal horror upon both, and longing for the time when they could be sent out of the vessel. The captain, as we have before observed, was very superstitious and very fond of his bottle. In the morning he would be sober and pray. In the afternoon he would be drunk and swear at the very saints whose protection he had invoked but a few hours before.
"May holy Saint Antonio preserve us and keep us from temptation," said he on the morning, after a conversation with the passengers about the phantom ship. "All the saints protect us from harm," continued he, taking off his hat reverentially and crossing himself. "Let me but rid myself of these two dangerous men without accident, and I will offer up 100 wax candles of 3 ounces each to the shrine of the Virgin upon my safe anchoring off the Tower of Belem."
In the evening he changed his language.
"Now, if that maldetto Saint Antonio don't help us, may he feel the coals of hell yet, damn him and his pigs too. If he has the courage to do his duty, all will be well. But he is a cowardly wretch. He cares for nobody, and will not help those who call upon him in trouble."
"Carambo!
That for you!" exclaimed the captain, looking at the small shrine of the saint at the bittacle, and snapping his fingers at the image. "That for you, you useless wretch, who never help us in our trouble. The Pope must canonize some better saints for us, for all we have now are worn out. They could do something formerly, but now I would not give 2 ounces of gold for the whole calendar. As for you, you lazy old scoundrel," continued the captain, shaking his fist at the poor Saint Antonio.
The ship had now gained off the southern coast of Africa, and was about 100 miles from the Lagoulas coast. The morning was beautiful, a slight ripple only turned over the waves. The breeze was light and steady, and the vessel was standing on a wind at the rate of about 4 miles an hour.
"Blessed be the holy saints," said the captain, who had just gained the deck. "Another little slant in our favour, and we shall lay our course. Again, I say, blessed be the holy saints, and particularly our worthy patron Saint Antonio, who has taken under his peculiar protection the Nostra Senora da Monte. We have a prospect of fine weather. Come, signors, let us down to breakfast, and after breakfast we will enjoy our cigarros upon the deck."
But the scene was soon changed. A bank of clouds rose up from the eastward with a rapidity that, to the seaman's eyes, was unnatural, and it soon covered the whole firmament. The sun was obscured, and all was one deep and unnatural gloom. The wind subsided, and the ocean was hushed. It was not exactly dark, but the heavens were covered with one red haze, which gave an appearance as if the world was in a state of conflagration. In the cabin the increased darkness was first observed by Philip, who went on deck. He was followed by the captain and passengers, who were in a state of amazement. It was unnatural and incomprehensible.
"Now, Holy Virgin, protect us! What can this be?" exclaimed the captain in a fright. "Holy Saint Antonio, protect us! but this is awful. There, there, shouted the sailors, pointing to the beam of the vessel. Every eye looked over the gunwale to witness what had occasioned such exclamations. Philip, Shrifton, and the captain were side by side. On the beam of the ship, not more than 2 cables' length distant, they beheld, slowly rising out of the water, the tapering masthead and spars of another vessel. She rose, and rose gradually. Her topmast and topsail yards, with the sails set, next made their appearance. Higher and higher she rose up from the element. Her lower masts and rigging, and lastly her hull, showed itself above the surface. Still she rose up, till her ports with her guns, and at last the whole of her flotage was above water, and there she remained close to them, with her main yard squared and hove to.
"Holy Virgin!" exclaimed the captain, breathless. "I have known ships to go down, but never to come up before. Now will I give 1,000 candles of 10 ounces each to the shrine of the Virgin to save us in this trouble. 1,000 wax candles! Hear me, blessed lady! 10 ounces each! Gentlemen!" cried the captain to the passengers, who stood aghast. "Why don't you promise? Promise, I say! Promise, at all events!"
"The Phantom Ship! The Flying Dutchman!" shrieked Shrifton. "I told you so, Philip Vanderdecken. There is your father!"
Philip's eyes had remained fixed on the vessel. He perceived that they were lowering down a boat from her quarter. "It is possible," thought he. "I shall now be permitted." And Philip put his hand into his bosom and grasped the relic. The gloom now increased, so that the strange vessel's hull could but just be discovered through the murky atmosphere. The seamen and passengers threw themselves down on their knees and invoked their saints. The captain ran down for a candle to light before the image of St. Antonio, which he took out of its shrine
and kissed with much apparent affection and devotion,
and then replaced. Shortly afterwards the splash of oars was heard alongside, and a voice calling out,
"I say, my good people, give us a rope from forward."
No one answered or complied with the request. Shrifton only went up to the captain and told him that if they offered to send letters they must not be received, or the vessel would be doomed, and all would perish. A man now made his appearance from over the gunwale at the gangway.
"You might as well have let me had a side rope, my hearties," said he,
as he stepped on deck.
"Where is the captain?"
"Here,"
replied the captain, trembling from head to foot. The man who accosted him appeared a weather-beaten seaman, dressed in a fur cap and canvas petticoats. He held some letters in his hand.
"What do you want?"
at last screamed the captain.
"Yes, what do you want?"
continued Shrifton.
"What, you here, pilot?" observed the man. "Well, I thought you had gone to Davy's locker long enough ago,"
replied Shrifton, turning away.
"Why, the fact is, captain, we have had very foul weather, and we wish to send letters home. I do believe that we shall never get round this cape."
"I can't take them," cried the captain.
"Can't take them? Well, it's very odd, but every ship refuses to take our letters. It's very unkind. Seamen should have a feeling for brother seamen, especially in distress. God knows we wish to see our wives and families again, and it would be a matter of comfort to them if they only could hear from us."
"I cannot take your letters. The saints preserve us," replied the captain.
"We have been a long while out," said the seaman, shaking his head.
"How long?"
inquired the captain, not knowing what to say.
"Well, can't tell. Our almanac was blown overboard, and we have lost our reckoning. We never have our latitude exact now, for we cannot tell the sun's declination for the right day."
"Let me see your letters," said Philip, advancing and taking them out of the seaman's hands.
"They must not be touched,"
screamed Shrifton.
"Out, monster," replied Philip. "Who dares interfere with me?"
"Doomed! Doomed! Doomed!"
shrieked Shrifton, running up and down the deck, and then breaking into a wild fit of laughter.
"Touch not the letters,"
said the captain,
trembling as if in an ague fit. Philip made no reply, but held his hand out for the letters.
"Here is one from our second mate to his wife at Amsterdam, who lives on Vassa Quay."
"Vassa Quay has long been gone, my good friend. There is now a large dock for ships where it once was," replied Philip.
"Impossible," replied the man. "Here is another
from the boatswain
to his father, who lives in the old marketplace."
"The old marketplace has long been pulled down,
and there now stands a church upon the spot."
"Impossible," replied the seaman. "Here is another from myself to my sweetheart, Vrouw Ketzer, with money to buy her a new brooch."
Philip shook his head. "I remember seeing an old lady of that name buried some 30 years ago."
"Impossible. I left her young and blooming. Here's one for the house of Slutz and Co., to whom the ship belongs."
"There's no such house now," replied Philip, "but I have heard that many years ago there was a firm of that name."
"Impossible. You must be laughing at me. Here is a letter from our captain to his son."
"Give it me," replied Philip, seizing the letter. He was about to break the seal when Shrifton snatched it out of his hand and threw it over the lee gunwale.
"That's a scurvy trick for an old shipmate," observed the seaman.
Shrifton made no reply, but catching up the other letters which Philip had laid down on the capstan, he hurled them after the first. The strange seaman shed tears and walked again to the side.
"It is very hard, very unkind," observed he, as he descended. "The time may come when you may wish that your family should know your situation."
So saying, he disappeared. In a few seconds was heard the sound of the oars retreating from the ship.
"Holy St. Antonio!" exclaimed the captain. "I am lost in wonder and fright. Steward, bring me up the arrack."
The steward ran down for the bottle. Being as much alarmed as his captain, he helped himself before he brought it up to his commander.
"Now,"
said the captain, after keeping his mouth for 2 minutes to the bottle and draining it to the bottom, "what is to be done next?"
"I'll tell you,"
said Shrifton, going up to him.
"That man there has a charm hung round his neck. Take it from him and throw it overboard, and your ship will be saved. If not, it will be lost with every soul on board."
"Yes, yes, it's all right, depend upon it," cried the sailors. "Fools," replied Philip. "Do you believe that wretch? Did you not hear the man who came on board recognize him and call him shipmate? He is the party whose presence on board will prove so unfortunate."
"Yes, yes," cried the sailors. "It's all right. The man did call him shipmate." "I tell you it's all wrong," cried Shrifton. "That is the man. Let him give up the charm."
"Yes, yes, let him give up the charm," cried the sailors, and they rushed upon Philip.
Philip started back to where the captain stood.
"Madmen, know ye what ye are about? It is the holy cross that I wear round my neck. Throw it overboard if you dare, and your souls are lost for ever."
And Philip took the relic from his bosom and showed it to the captain.
"No, no, men,"
exclaimed the captain, who was now more settled in his nerves.
"That won't do. The saints protect us."
The seamen, however, became clamorous. One portion were for throwing Shrifton overboard, the other for throwing Philip. At last, the point was decided by the captain, who directed the small skiff hanging astern to be lowered down and ordered both Philip and Shrifton to get into it. The seamen approved of this arrangement, as it satisfied both parties. Philip made no objection. Shrifton screamed and fought, but he was tossed into the boat. There he remained trembling in the stern sheets, while Philip, who had seized the sculls, pulled away from the vessel in the direction of the phantom ship.
The end of chapter 41. Recording by Andy Sames.
Chapter 42 of The Phantom Ship by Frederick Marriott. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain.
Chapter 42. In a few minutes the vessel which Philip and Shrifton had left was no longer to be discerned through the thick haze. The phantom ship was still in sight, but at a much greater distance from them than she was before. Philip pulled hard towards her, but although hove to, she appeared to increase her distance from the boat. For a short time he paused on his oars to regain his breath, when Shrifton rose up and took his seat in the stern sheets of the boat.
"You may pull and pull, Philip van der Decken," observed Shrifton, "but you will not gain that ship. No, no, that cannot be. We may have a long cruise together, but you will be as far from your object at the end of it as you are now at the commencement. Why don't you throw me overboard again? You would be all the lighter."
"I threw you overboard in a state of frenzy," replied Philip, "when you attempted to force from me my relic."
"And have I not endeavoured to make others take it from you this very day? Have I not?"
"You have," rejoined Philip, "but I am now convinced that you are as unhappy as myself, and that in what you are doing you are only following your destiny, as I am mine. Why and wherefore I cannot tell, but we are both engaged in the same mystery. If the success of my endeavours depends upon guarding the relic, the success of yours depends upon your obtaining it, and defeating my purpose by so doing. In this matter we are both agents, and you have been, as far as my mission is concerned, my most active enemy. But, Shrifton, I have not forgotten, and never will, that you were kindly and did advise my poor Amin, that you prophesied to her what would be her fate if she did not listen to your counsel, that you were no enemy of hers, although you have been and are still mine. Although my enemy, for her sake, I forgive you, and will not attempt to harm you."
"You do, then, forgive your enemy, Philip van der Decken," replied Shrifton mournfully, "for such I acknowledge myself to be."
"I do, with all my heart, with all my soul," replied Philip.
"Then you have conquered me, Philip van der Decken. You have now made me your friend, and your wishes are about to be accomplished. You would know who I am. Listen. When your father, defying the Almighty's will in his rage, took my life, he was vouchsafed a chance of his doom being cancelled through the merits of his son. I had also my appeal, which was for vengeance. It was granted that I should remain on earth and thwart your will, that as long as we were enemies you should not succeed, but that when you had conformed to the highest attribute of Christianity, proved on the Holy Cross, that of forgiving your enemy, your task should be fulfilled. Philip van der Decken, you have forgiven your enemy, and both our destinies are now accomplished."
As Shrifton spoke, Philip's eyes were fixed upon him. He extended his hand to Philip. It was taken, and as it was pressed, the form of the pilot wasted, as it were, into the air, and Philip found himself alone.
"Father of mercy, I thank thee," said Philip, "that my task is done, and that I again may meet my Amin."
Philip then pulled towards the phantom ship, and found that she no longer appeared to leave him. On the contrary, every minute he was nearer and nearer, and at last he threw in his oars, climbed up her sides, and gained her deck. The crew of the vessel crowded round him.
"Your captain," said Philip, "I must speak with your captain."
"Who shall I say, sir?"
demanded one, who appeared to be the first mate.
"Who?" replied Philip. "Tell him his son would speak to him. His son, Philip van der Decken."
Shouts of laughter from the crew followed this answer of Philip's, and the mate, as soon as they ceased, observed with a smile,
"You forget, sir. Perhaps you would say his father?"
"Tell him his son, if you please," replied Philip. "Take no note of grey hairs."
"Well, sir, here he is, coming forward,"
replied the mate, stepping aside and pointing to the captain.
"What is all this?" inquired the captain. "Are you Philip van der Decken, the captain of this vessel?"
"I am, sir," replied the other.
"You appear not to know me, but how can you? You saw me but when I was only 3 years old. Yet may you remember a letter which you gave to your wife?"
"Ha," replied the captain.
"And who then are you?"
"Time has stopped with you, but with those who live in the world he stops not. And for those who pass a life of misery, he hurries on still faster. In me behold your son, Philip Vanderdecken, who has obeyed your wishes, and after a life of such peril and misery as few have passed, has at last fulfilled his vow and now offers to his father the precious relic that he required to kiss. Philip drew out the relic and held it towards his father. As if a flash of lightning had passed through his mind, the captain of the vessel started back, clasped his hands, fell on his knees, and wept.
"My son, my son!" exclaimed he,
rising and throwing himself into Philip's arms.
"My eyes are opened. The Almighty knows how long they have been obscured."
Embracing each other, they walked aft, away from the men, who were still crowded at the gangway.
"My son, my noble son, before the charm is broken, before we resolve, as we must, into the elements, oh, let me kneel in thanksgiving and contrition. My son, my noble son, receive a father's thanks," exclaimed Vanderdecken.
Then, with tears of joy and penitence, he humbly addressed himself to that being whom he once so awfully defied. The elder Vanderdecken knelt down. Philip did the same, still embracing each other with one arm, while they raised on high the other and prayed. For the last time the relic was taken from the bosom of Philip and handed to his father, and his father raised his eyes to heaven and kissed it. And as he kissed it, the long tapering upper spars of the phantom vessel, the yards and sails that were set, fell into dust, fluttered in the air, and sank upon the wave. Then mainmast, foremast, bowsprit, everything above the deck, crumbled into atoms and disappeared. Again he raised the relic to his lips, and the work of destruction continued. The heavy iron guns sank through the decks and disappeared. The crew of the vessel, who were looking on, crumbled down into skeletons and dust, and fragments of ragged garments. And there were none left on board the vessel, in the semblance of life, but the father and the son. Once more did he put the sacred emblem to his lips, and the beams and timbers separated. The decks of the vessel slowly sank, and the remnants of the hull floated upon the water. And as the father and son, the one young and vigorous, the other old and decrepit, still kneeling, still embracing with their hands raised to heaven, sank slowly under the deep blue wave, the lurid sky was for a moment illuminated by a lightning cross. Then did the clouds which obscured the heavens roll away swift as thought. The sun again burst out in all his splendour. The rippling waves appeared to dance with joy. The screaming seagull again whirled in the air, and the scared albatross once more slumbered on the wing. The porpoise tumbled and tossed in his sportive play. The albicore and dolphin leapt from the sparkling sea. All nature smiled, as if it rejoiced that the charm was dissolved for ever, and that the Phantom Ship was no more.
The end of The Phantom Ship by Frederick Marriott. Recording by Andy Sames.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.